Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is Tuesday, January 19th, 2016, and it is 1:30 in the afternoon. It is also the first day of the legislative session, and so we are getting off to a brisk start. But I was just sharing with my vice chair, Senator Giesel, that there were 15 bills referred to this committee that were read across the floor today. So we are ready to get started. I want to thank, and I'm Senator Mia Costello, by the way. I want to thank our recording secretary, Carrie, and the LIO operator, Donna. Without your help, we couldn't have hearings. I also want to welcome Senator Ellis, Vice Chair Senator Giesel, and Senator Stevens, and my aide, Weston Eiler, who's here to facilitate this. This afternoon, we are hearing some presentations from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I'd like to welcome Commissioner Laddick, who's here. Thank you for showing up. I think you wanted to make some initial comments. And then with you this afternoon, you're joined by the Division of Economic Development Director, Brittany Cioni Haywood. Welcome. And with that, Commissioner, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Welcome back to Juneau. My name is Chris Laddick, Commissioner of Commerce, Community, Economic Development. And thanks for the opportunity to briefly address you today and introduce the directors and staff who will be presenting. As we continue to face tighter budgets and hard decisions, we're working to think outside of the box on how we deliver services, how we prioritize, and what are truly essential department functions. I know that you and your colleagues are thinking along the same lines. I look forward to working with you to find compromises that protect Alaska's best interests and as we move forward toward a fiscally responsible future. Today, you will hear from four sections of the Department of Commerce. Director of Economic Development, Brittany Cioni Haywood, will update you on the tourism marketing program. ASME Communications Director Tyson Fisk will provide you with information on their ongoing work to promote Alaska seafood and grow our market share. Lori Winghire, Division of Insurance Director, will present on the state of Alaska's insurance market and discuss national trends and concerns. And last but not least, Janie Hovenden, Director of Corporate Business and Professional Licensing, will update you on the successes we've achieved in reducing professional licensing deficits and improving our processes for setting fees. As you all know, there are many programs within DCCED, including DCRA, Division of Banking. Today's presentation is a great opportunity to kick off a discussion on some of our hot-button issues, and I look forward to further conversations on these topics throughout the remainder of our legislative session. And I apologize, but I have to head to a cabinet meeting. But thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate you coming to the meeting. Welcome, Brittany, and if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record, so those listening online can identify your voice.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me and letting me do this presentation on our tourism marketing program. My name is Brittany Cioni Haywood. I'm the Division Director for the Division of Economic Development in the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. So today we'll be looking at the tourism marketing program that the division oversees. And I want to start off with some good news that tourism is growing. The state-funded tourism marketing program helps to reach a global and a national audience and to promote all regions and communities within the state. The Alaska Tourism Marketing Program has been very efficient in increasing the numbers of visitors to the state. And I want to start with winter tourism. Winter tourism is up by 8%, which is great. In extending that, it also helps those businesses in that area have further months outside of the standard May to September for income. And so we get closer to a year-round basis. The summer tourism has also grown by 12%. And we've seen a lot of that come off of an increase in cruise ship passengers, which had an increase of 3% in the summer of 2015 alone.
Ms. Haywood, also want to mention for members, I would like to have this be a discussion, so feel free to ask questions as we move through this. And the first two presenters, the Tourism Marketing and the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, these are marketing programs. We're focusing essentially on programs that are very tied to the economy and help grow the economy. So my question is, with the 8%, 12% increase, is that since when?
I'm sorry. That's over the four-year period that CCED has overseen the program.
Okay.
Also need to consider the average visitor spending when we look at the impact to the economy. And the average visitor to Alaska spends $941 per person. If we break out international tourists, that goes up to just over $1,100. They tend to spend a bit more. The economic benefit of tourism to the Alaskan economy, as measured through the economic impact of the Alaska Visitors Industry Report, is estimated at $3.9 billion.
Could you explain that through the chair?
Senator Stevens?
Could you explain what that means, economic impact? That's not just the money brought in. It's more than that, right?
Yes, Senator Stevens, through the chair. That is more than that. That would be a total economic impact, which would include direct, indirect, and induced effects. So, you know, as you pay somebody to in the tourism industry, they also go and buy stuff at a grocery store to, you know, provide their money to a bank to use or a gas station, whatever the case may be, which then turns that money over in the economy. And so that would be encompassing all of those effects into that $3.9 billion.
Thank you.
Ms. Haywood, who did that study?
That was Chair Costello, that was the McDowell Group.
Thank you.
The tourism marketing program is research-based, so we do a number of research studies that have been funded, and it allows us to make decisions on those marketing programs that we want to put forth. And we also work with the Alaska Tourism Marketing Board, known as ATMB, which Senator Costello serves on as the Senate representative. So she's been engaged in those conversations. And there is a meeting tomorrow, actually, in Fairbanks of the ATMB. I wanted to mention that because the discussion is going to focus around metrics, program metrics, and unit cost. And from that data that's gathered, they will then decide what elements they use going forward.
Thank you.
The annual conversion study, which is what is demonstrated in that graph, allows us to evaluate media purchases and identify those that are going to be most effective going forward to bringing visitors to the state. And I wanted to note the compounding effect that is on the graph of the marketing program. People who see an ad and respond that within the same year, so they see the ad and they come in the same year, that's 10.6%. But what we find is people often take a few years to plan their trip to Alaska. We are a very vast state. There's lots of things to do and see here. And so it takes them a while to narrow their focus on what they want to experience when they're in state. So if
Thank
we go
you,
out
Ms.
4 years, I'm sorry.
Ms. Haywood, first of all, I wanted to welcome the Senate President.
Oh.
Welcome, Senator Meyer.
Thank you.
And if you don't mind, as you go through your presentation, if you mention the page number that you're on, just so that we can follow through.
Sure.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I apologize for being late, but the House is a little slow. I had to wait for them to notify me that they're in session. Thank you.
Thank you. So my name is Brittany Cheney Haywood. I'm the director of DEB. So I'm on slide 3. And if we look at the conversion rate on a four-year period, then we're at just over 26% of people who experience that Alaska media element and then decide to come and actually book a trip to the state. We also do continue through the vacation planners. We gather information, continue with a newsletter out to people so that we can keep the idea of visiting Alaska fresh in their minds, and we direct them to the travel website, which is continuously updated.
Ms. Haywood, yes. Alaska is considered a long-haul destination. Can you explain to the members of the committee who are we competing against to attract those visitors?
So as far as other destinations? I'm sorry to clarify. Yes. So a lot of we have a lot of competition with different states, obviously within the U.S., but then also those international destinations. Do you go to Alaska or do you go to Australia or New Zealand? Would be some large competitors of ours.
Okay.
I'm not sure what's going on with the presentation. So. But I am on slide 4 for the committee members. And this is demonstrating the tourism marketing investment, so the what the budget has been over the last, well, going back to 04. In order to see continued growth, we believe that there needs to be continued investment in tourism marketing. If Alaska's tourism message is not delivered globally and on a consistent basis, we believe that the numbers will decline. This will be gradual due to kind of that booking and taking a number of years to just commit to coming to the state, but we believe that there will be less people kind of down the line without maintaining some sort of marketing program.
Ms. Haywood, you had mentioned at the beginning that winter tourism is up 8% and summer is up 12% in the last 4 years. So is there a lag between the investment in marketing and then the result that you see? I mean, I assume there would be, since you said that it takes a while for individuals to make that decision. So can we expect that increase to start deteriorating?
To the chair, yes. I believe we will. And it typically, we would estimate 2 to 3 years for that to occur because of that timing where we're still having people who have decided they want to come and they're actively planning that vacation. But at some point, if our message isn't out there, then maybe they decide to go to Texas or Australia or New Zealand somewhere else instead of coming to Alaska.
Senator Stevens?
I don't see a chart that would show us where the money's come from that you're referring to here. This is not just state investment, is it?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, no, it is not. That includes the program receipts in addition to the general funds that have been allocated to the program.
It would be nice to see a pie chart that would show us where those monies come from. And what is the state percentage then?
Currently, Senator Stevens, through the chair, program receipts have been somewhere around $2.7 million. That would vary a little bit between year to year, but that's kind of an average figure.
Out of
last year, we were at, I believe, $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
So approximately $7 million in general fund. Prior to that, I believe we had about $15 million in general fund. I can absolutely get you a breakout of that, though.
Thank you.
And Ms. Haywood, it's my understanding that those program receipts are voluntary, that are paid by tourism operators to be in the vacation planner?
Chair, yes, they are. The vacation planner, we also have some cooperative marketing programs with Yukon, British Columbia, and Alberta as well that does bring in some funding that would be considered in that program receipted money.
Okay. And I have a follow-up question. Related to my one earlier about competition, when we see the price of gasoline so low, do travelers then decide to take road trips to nearby states rather than choosing to fly? I mean, is there any data that would indicate that in addition to the drop in marketing dollars, we might not see the uptick in visitors in the next few years, but we can also expect even fewer because of that? I mean, is there any, can you comment on that?
Chair, I'm not sure that I could actually. I would be happy to do a little research on that.
Okay.
I would expect, having an economics background, that we would see that some of those low oil prices might actually offset if we see a decline in plane tickets or other type of, transportation costs such as driving up, that might help offset some of the lack of marketing dollars for a little while. I mean, this is a complex formula that includes global economics, the price of oil, consumer confidence, and in addition to the active marketing that the program does.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm hoping that helps.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can follow up on that, it would seem like with the low oil prices that should make, you know, cruise ship fares pretty reasonable, and perhaps people who've been wanting to take cruise ship to Alaska, you know, now can afford it. I don't know. Are you seeing any correlation there between the price of oil and the cruise ship visitors in particular?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, not that I've seen so far, but again, I'd be happy. I would expect that as well, that as those ticket prices, both for potentially airfare, cruise, or driving up, mm-hmm. that would encourage people to say, hey, this is a great time to come to Alaska. I want to do that road trip. And so, you know, who knows when oil prices will be lower, hopefully not in the near future, but at least for the state of Alaska, but to have them come and, you know, push them to make that trip now.
And you have another
Senator
question,
Meyer, sure.
And I may be out of sync here with your presentation, but how do you coordinate your efforts, like with the Anchorage Convention Visitors Bureau, Fairbanks has a Visitors Bureau, I think Juneau does as well, and they put a lot of money towards marketing in those groups as well.
Yes, Senator Meyer, through the chair. The state tends to try and do kind of overarching or bigger projects, such as the television placement, when we discuss public relations, working with national journalists to coordinate some of those bigger things that potentially might not be done through the visitor centers. Even though they're larger and they represent their areas, they still might not have the funding to do that. I mean, television advertising is very expensive. And so to take that on and try and fill a role where those other businesses and organizations will not. Pretty much the only other businesses and organizations that would be large enough to do national television placement are going to be the cruise ships. And they do their own, and they have very large marketing budgets of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So on slide 5, and I think the presentation is still not working, but this is an overall allocation guide to the elements within the program. I provide this graph mainly for reference and context as we get into the specifics of these elements. The tourism marketing, we do try and allocate so that we're covering the broad spectrum. We know that some businesses are more dependent upon domestic visitors, while others are more dependent upon international visitors. The bulk of the budget is spent on domestic consumer advertising because most of our visitors do come from the United States. But as I mentioned earlier, international visitors tend to spend more and they tend to stay longer, so it's important to keep that messaging in front of those audiences as well. Moving on to slide 6. This is the public relations that I just referred to. And the public relations program revolves with working with journalists. We work with roughly 600 journalists every year. There are several media events that we sponsor where they can get more information about the state of Alaska. Journalists come, they experience the state, and they provide very rich content about a wide range of experiences across the state. The average value of each article is estimated at $91,000, and for every dollar invested in the public relations program, it's estimated to return $68 in promotional value. So a couple of the stories that are in the slide. The bottom one was recently published in an Arts Focus magazine, and the writer, Michelle Newman, had attended one of our media events and then had come up. And she visited Southeast Alaska and Fairbanks and highlighted kind of the stunning beauty, of course, that is in those areas, the art and our rich native culture. In addition to working with print journalists, we also work with trying to get on the broadcast networks. We look for those opportunities. Last year, we worked with PBS and the program Movable Feast. And the state spent just under $10,000 on this project, and it allowed us to reach an audience of over 1 million people with 2 episodes focused on Alaska.
Ms. Haywood, I have a question about the average value of each article at $91,000. How is that measured? And then, obviously, depending on the placement of the article, it will probably have a huge range. I mean, is there, can you just provide us maybe at some point information on how many articles were written about Alaska and the specific value? But right now, if you could answer how that's calculated.
Of course, Chair. The calculation is done, basically, if we had to go out and try and provide that information through print or other types of advertising, what it would cost us to do that. And so, typically, you know, articles are longer, they're a different perspective from that writer, and so they contain really invaluable, I mean, they're invaluable in the promotion. But we try and calculate, if we did have to go try and place that advertising, what would that cost us to do? I will absolutely get more specifics on the number of articles and measurement and stuff on
Thank
that.
You.
So moving on to slide 7, television advertising. So television advertising is beneficial because of its comprehensive view of the state. We also find that when we air television ads, it tends to boost all of our other program elements. The large audience can be reached by national television ads, and we're able to generate over 1.5 billion impressions. And by impressions, I mean the total audience in terms of people or households that are exposed to the same commercial on multiple occasions. For every dollar spent on television advertising, there is a return of $22.54 in visitor spending. And TV ads are designed to generate awareness and really elicit an emotional response that they want to come and visit the state of Alaska. Research conducted on the effectiveness of the state tourism program showed that 72% of people who saw an Alaska television commercial said it indicated that it increased their interest to visit our wonderful state.
Thank you.
Moving on to slide 8, our direct response advertising. We conduct a wide variety of advertising. This is really designed to encourage consumers to take advantage of requesting a vacation guide or visiting the official website, travelalaska.com. These sources consolidate travel information for all areas of the state, so it allows those consumers to view their options and start making those travel decisions. The campaign was refreshed this year to You Don't Want to Miss This. This campaign is designed to create a sense of urgency and encourage potential visitors to move forward with booking their travel to the state. The average cost to get a consumer to respond to a magazine ad, an online ad, or a direct mail package is $9.67, and actually convert that interest to a travel or a trip planned is about $30. Data shows that for each dollar spent on direct marketing advertising, we see a return of $114 in visitor spending. Moving on to slide 9. The research shows that consumers continue to use printed travel brochures as a way to find related websites and to continue to get more information on what they might want to do. The travel brochures and official website provide that comprehensive view. To cater to overseas markets, we also print several foreign language guides for distribution in Germany, Japan, Korea, and China. The state tourism website has been translated into 5 languages as well. And demand for print brochures and traffic to the website generated through the direct response programs and online marketing effort, and the cost to produce that guide is just under a dollar. There's a bit of a range on the types of collateral that are used. Moving on to slide 10, social media. It's a relatively small part of the budget. However, it is very influential when people are looking for travel recommendations. We are on all leading social media channels and have connected with more than 2.3 million people through that means. There's been more than 973,000 views on the YouTube videos about Alaska, which is a cost of about 4 cents per view. We also reach more than 18.8 million people by exposing them to ads on Facebook, and we have great engagement on Facebook with people sharing their experiences and adventures in Alaska. Moving on to slide 11, the travel trade marketing is important to many travelers, especially in international markets, because they tend to still rely pretty heavily on travel agents and tour operators in booking their trips. We conduct trade shows. It's estimated that it's about $800 per lead from a trade show. And product development tours, where we would bring, it's a familiarization tour, where we bring people over and have them actually experience Alaska firsthand to then go back and sell to those markets. And that's at about $1,370 per participant. Again, the travel trade marketing, we consist basically of one-on-one meetings with people in those international markets, trade show booths, familiarization or FAM tours, and destination training, where we provide training to them. What we find is people sell what they are used to and what they know, and so we provide online training as well as those in-person training. Moving on to slide 12, international markets do diversify the Alaska visitor portfolio, better enabling the state to weather global economic volatility, as well as providing significant growth opportunities. The international marketing program generates leads for tourism organizations such as hotels and tours, attractions, restaurants, shops, etc. And we do this again through one-on-one meetings with tour operators and media. Additionally, we give communities throughout the state a voice into those international markets. This type of marketing, we find that the sales missions, it's about $155 to generate those sales leads. Trade shows, $691. And again, the planner that's in the languages that I listed earlier is about $2.10 per planner distributed. So our top producing international markets include the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, German-speaking Europe, Japan, South Korea, and China. So that concludes the presentation that I had on the components of tourism marketing. I'm happy to entertain any further questions, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from members? Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you so much for what you're doing. It's really important to Alaska. One of the things that sort of strikes me is one of the important things about Alaska travel is that it's safe. It's in a world that's in turmoil with terrorism. There are places that I've been to that I would never go back to right now, and places that I haven't been to that I'm not going to go to either, just because of the threat of tourism, the threat of terrorist activity. So, is that can that be a part of your marketing scheme to say this is a safe place? And
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I wouldn't see why not, and absolutely, particularly given I think the world events over the last probably 6 months or so, whereas. You know, that would be, again, a selling point that, you know, we're domestic travel to the bulk of our travelers. But, again, yes, we're also a safe destination.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. My question is simply, what challenges do you see as we move forward in this historic budget environment that we have?
So the chair, I think the funding is going to be challenging. I think the ATMB and the program will work together to try and prioritize. They already did that last year when we were looking at the reduced budget for this year and really prioritizing what it is that we need to do. And then I was at that meeting and watched, you know, kind of like we need to save those revenue generating sources. So the vacation planner, absolutely going to do it, maintaining those joint marketing programs. Where actually the Canadian provinces put up more than we put in to those programs, if you look at it on an overall basis. Maintaining, you know, the website, because that is where people go to get that information. And then prioritizing there, what is it that we can lose? We cut all consumer trade shows because we decided that those were not as beneficial as these other programs and elements that we needed to keep. So again, as we reduce that funding, it's going to be going through that iteration all over again.
Are there opportunities to work, for example, with the seafood industry or areas where this, and other areas where the state has reached outside of the U.S.?
Chair, absolutely, I would think so. And we typically do. We have strong coordination with ASME and other programs to promote that. We work with, we also have the Maine Alaska program to try and, you know, sell the kind of those goods that are made within the state from typically small manufacturers, but not always. So, but we do kind of try and do that already, and I think it will become more important as we go forward that we combine those resources.
So do I, and I think the members will agree with that. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming before the committee, and we'll take a brief at ease while Tyson Fick joins us from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order, and with us now we have the Communications Director from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, Tyson Fick. Welcome to the committee, and you will begin, I guess, with your presentation on marketing of Alaska seafood.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak to you today. For the record, I'm Tyson Fick, the Communications Director at the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. A big part of my job is sharing and elucidating the things that we do as an organization, which I'm really proud of, and something that people will often see if I do speak is I try to put in a picture of my kids somewhere. So there they are, the two cutest crewmen in the commercial seafood industry, Nate and Riley, for the record. So we are a public-private partnership. A public corporation with a governor-appointed board of directors that has five processors, two commercial harvesters, and some ex officio members, both from the administration and from each house of the legislature. We're the official seafood promotion arm, and we market Alaska seafood in a generic way. We're prohibited from marketing specific to a region or specific to a particular company. So that's key in how we work in the market. Our mission is to increase the value of Alaska seafood, and I moved ahead. You know, there's a lot to it with collaborative marketing programs and aligning with industry and supporting the sustainability efforts of the state, but really when I look at efforts of our organization, we always have a focus on, is it increasing value? Next slide. This is what our budget looks like, our budget request coming forward this year. You'll see $3.428 million in general fund match. That's down from, I believe, just over $4.9 or so last year total, and down from a high of $7.8 million for several years. In the last few years, it's been down. So, you know, as you can see, we're more than 50% down from our GF of just 3 years ago. We have 20 full-time exempt employees in Juneau, Kodiak, and in Seattle, where our domestic marketing program's housed. The industry tax version, if you look at the pie graph, it's SDPR, which is the industry tax. That is a voluntary 0.5% tax on X vessel value across all species, all regions, and then another 4.5 in general funds, and you see the general fund match there. So all told, the general fund contribution is about a quarter of our total budget going into this year.
Madam Chair?
Senator Stevens?
Just a reflection. This all changed seriously when we passed a bill that changed the makeup of ASME from primarily a fisherman's organization to one in which the processors played a major role. And I think it's remarkable when you see that the industry has put in $16 million. And in the past, it seems to me we have sort of tried to keep tourism and ASME fairly similar. Weren't your budget, general fund budgets, pretty similar at one time? And now they seem so different, because I see now that nothing against tourism at all, but now it seems like tourism is getting like $7 million and from the general fund, and ASME is only getting $3 million. Has that been a change? What's been your experience in how we have funded from the general fund?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, we... The big change happened first in 2003 when our structure went from 0.3 across the board plus an additional 1% for just salmon fishermen to pay, which you can imagine created some acrimony if we were out selling, you know, promoting cod, say, for instance. And then with the rest of the industry, which whitefish makes up about 65% of the volume, they said, well, it's the Alaska Salmon Marketing Institute, and I don't really get anything out of it. So that basic structure of making it 0.5% across the board was very good for industry buy-in in particular, and for stable funding. As far as the differences between seafood marketing and how much we've gotten from the state, which is all very appreciated, versus tourism, I would need more knowledge specifically about the tourism part. I'm pretty focused on fish. But what I can say is that our industries are fundamentally different in the way that we sell product in a commodity form so that there's a point to take a tax. You know, to take a tax at X vessel, when the fisherman sells the fish to the processor, well, that's when we take fisheries business tax. That's when we take, you know, a number of taxes throughout in the state, and that kind of makes a nice, tidy way. You know, in previous life, working in the legislature, there was lots of talk of how to address revenue for tourism marketing specifically, but that's, again, I'm in the fish business, so I would hope that they would be able to help me with that answer specifically.
Thank you. Well, it's good to see the state is still involved, and even though we're facing tough times, I hope we can maintain that involvement in the future.
We very much hope so, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on, our number one metric is also the metric that we have least control over in greatest sense, ex vessel value. It's where everything we talk about, well, what's the price of fish, what's the value of the fishery? This often gets us in a difficult situation of chasing price versus value. There's other things that we can look at, say permit values. There's other ways to address whether or not value is up. But certainly you look over time, over 10 years, the same volume of fish produces, you know, we're almost an additional $1 billion, you know, $0.7 to $0.75 billion more value, and that's going to go on. Most of our fisheries are fully utilized, meaning that we're not just going to go out and catch more fish because there's potentially a market for it. There's biological need that absolutely trumps any of our marketing efforts or our industry efforts. So the way to increase value is to increase the per fish value, and marketing is certainly a way of doing that. Just included a couple of points about the size of the industry. We all know it's a big deal, but, you know, we catch more fish than the rest of the U.S. combined. We'd be the sixth largest exporter of seafood in the world if we were a country. But, you know, if you compare, it puts us in a pretty tough playing field when groups like our primary competitor, the Norwegian Seafood Export Council, has a budget of $60 million. And I've heard of $10 million just in the U.S. for salmon alone. Well, export markets are...
I have to make a comment there. I mean, it's not unlike the comparison of the tourism
Absolutely.
Marketing efforts that, for example, the state of Hawaii invests. So we're blessed with resources here in our natural beauty and also in our seafood and other areas, as Senator Giesel is well aware. So sometimes I think the product speaks more for itself than in other areas because we have that. But I think in these times we have to be very careful about where we're balancing, making this balance, because we have industries that do bring in quite a bit to the state. So.
Absolutely. What that does, though, by looking just at the X vessel and the combination of price and value, it does give us the opportunity to talk about the market effects that we're working in, and export markets are particularly important for us. We export to 120 different countries. Seafood is one of the most traded commodities in the world. Substantial amount of money. Ground fish makes up most of it, and that's, we're talking about cod, pollock, flatfish, things like that, but then salmon is a big player. China is our largest single trading partner, but when you look at final place where product winds up, U.S., Europe, and Japan are by far the biggest three markets for us. A lot goes through China and either back here or to other places. And the EU and Japan are the largest export markets. And it's about two-thirds of the value. So the global factors impacting value have been huge. And you saw that the ex-vessel value went down. But the strong dollar, and there's a mother of all typos in there where it says weak dollars and the ones that you guys have printed. But the strong dollar has a real combined negative effect, both empowering our competitors, making it easier to sell seafood into the United States and other markets we're trying to get into, and also lowering the buying capacity of our buyers. So, you know, if it's down 25%, well, that's 25% less fish than that they can afford at the same time of some near record harvest. The Russian pollock certification, that instead of increasing the Russian value to what ours is, it drove our pollock value down. The Russian embargo, more Atlantic cod, but there's some very positive factors, including sereni supply, long-term demand versus supply. We keep making more people, but there's only so much food we can take from the ocean, so it's definitely a product in demand. and a strong brand that we've managed to build over several years since ASME started in 1981. And then there's this guy. The effect of the Russian embargo and the Ukrainian conflict has been huge on our markets, particularly salmon and particularly pink salmon. That was our number one pink salmon roe market. So you go back a couple of years ago, and it was about 45% of the value was the roe out of the pink salmon. Now that has completely evaporated those markets, which means that that roe has very little value. In the meantime, we can't sell product into Russia, which has been a pretty good market for us, and they're still allowed to sell product into the United States. And they've got the currency benefit, and they have many of the similar products like sockeye salmon. So it's a very tough situation with the man on the bear.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was a dispute there for a while that the wild salmon could be labeled and then the farm salmon would be labeled farm salmon. Is that still in effect, or did I hear where that's no longer a requirement?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, typically it has to be labeled wild and country of origin. That always seems to be in the hopper for changes because the interests of the domestic seafood industry are not always in alignment with the interests of the domestic beef and pork and chicken industries, and they certainly have a lot more power in that game than we do. You know, the GMO thing has come up and the labeling for that. I think Senator Murkowski did a nice job with requiring a plan for some labeling there. Generally, people in all of our consumer polling say that people want to know where their food comes from, where their seafood comes from, and our story fits in very well with that, and we'll continue to push for always requiring labeling and some knowledge of origin and provenance of where seafood's from in the market in all places.
So I guess so that's still required, if I may, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Stevens?
Before we go on from that picture of the Russian president on a bear, we would be glad to offer the Senate president to ride a bear if you think it would help.
Thanks.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, with Photoshop, anything is possible.
Yeah, Photoshop's fine.
Really quickly, we've got some programs. One of our metrics in the performance measures is where we place on menus. We're the second most branded item on menus in the largest chain restaurants around the country. If people have Alaska seafood and they're going the extra mile and paying the extra money for Alaska, they want to tell their customers about it because they prefer it. So we are ahead of Oreo cookies and behind Angus beef. Here's a smattering of some of the groups that the food service program works with, and I bring this up only to say that there's a place for every product, and the same thing can be carried through to the international program, where, you know, king salmon and king crab may be in the fine dining white linen, but then we also are looking for places for surimi, for, you know, pollock block, for some of the other programs. And so, you know, there's a home for it across food service operators, but there's also a home for it across international markets.
Mr. Fick, where in this graph would you put school nutrition?
Through the chair, Madam Chairman. That is part of the institutional program, and that is definitely part of the food service program. We have programs with genuine Alaska pollock producers, making sure it's a USDA-approved food and allowed into the food system. We also have programs through the food aid program, getting seafood approved for WIC and things like that, and food banks that have all been very successful. But, you know, between the universities and public schools, that's definitely a market that we're looking at, even if it wasn't specifically included on that list of food service operators.
Is Alaska seafood served at your children's school?
Madam Chairman, yes, it is. There are both fish sticks that are pollock product and salmon, I believe pink salmon, under kind of a fish taco program that they do.
I would like to see that expanded. I've visited schools recently and I have not seen Alaska salmon served, but I think that's a direction that we should look towards in our schools.
Okay, well taken.
Your kids are lucky.
Yes. I keep telling them that. But another place we look to how we're doing are how we increase exports to destination countries. As you can see, a long-term growth in that arena. Every year we compete for a competitive grant from the Federal Market Access Program and the USDA. There's a number of about 200 co-operators that we all compete for this grant. We get somewhere around $4.5 million a year from that to fund our international programs. This year was kind of exciting. We have another, we were awarded a grant through the Emerging Markets Program to do a trade mission in Southeast Asia, where we'll be taking industry members and going to Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Again, trying to break open new markets, and every little bit helps. And we're not in any place where we're going to overlook any potential niche market for ourselves. Media relations, another metric that we use, and this is where I work every day, out there trying to win the media game. And it takes a lot of positive pitching and trying to line up stories, a combination of things, whether it's advertising or fam tours and things like that. Suffice it to say, we're doing a very nice job of getting positive press as it relates to our oceans and our fisheries. Advertising, this is a piece of that last number that you saw. I just want to point this out in that we are shifting more and more towards digital because that's where the eyeballs are. There is a place for print advertising in a perfect world, absolutely, but then we are looking for integration, whether it's a homepage takeover that then maybe has an event space and maybe something else, so we can kind of always try to maximize our dollars. So you look for banner ads and then other places where there's lots of traffic that are specific to food and in the demographic that we're looking for.
So we just heard that in the tourism industry that many people still use the print material to make their choice about where to travel. Does that, I mean, I was thinking this at the time, but is that because of the age of the consumer, perhaps? You might find, I mean, this obviously is a question for someone else, but Ms. Hayward, but is it because seafood consumers have a wide variety of ages? Is that what you find, or do we even know that?
Madam Chairman, I think it's specific to what we're looking at in our advertising versus a printed travel guide that maybe has a little more durability where it can sit there and you can compare it, and we're looking for that. Well, what am I going to get today? Oh, well, here's a salmon recipe, and it says to get something from Alaska, and it's the summer, and boom, there we are. It's less like a long-term decision, like maybe someday I'll get to eat a piece of salmon. It's kind of like, well, tonight. What's tonight? And that's where our game is maybe a little more disposable, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. Trying to stay top of mind. Really, what I think is the most interesting program the retail, ASME Domestic Retail did this year was a frozen sockeye promotion going into this year, following on a huge run in Bristol Bay the year before. Our board came together this spring in March, April, and said, we're looking at a huge forecast, and we have a big issue. What can ASME do today? And so we put together almost 5,000 demos in retail outlets across the country and saw an average lift of 56.2% in sales. That's before the season, a frozen inventory. And then we continued it with demos throughout the season, and now we're going to be looking at a Lenten season, a remake of this. This was reviewed by our board and our committees and found to be very, very successful as far as moving product and trying to elevate the value. It was patterned, and the similar thing was done overseas, in Japan in particular. We saw demos, and we're always looking at when we do run a promotion with a partner, and that's another area I'd say we're maybe a little different than tourism, as we run partnered promotions with retailers and food service, the people actually selling the product. So, we provide some assets, say photos, maybe a little bit of money, and then they go to market and they really see the benefit in their own stores. Next one, a smoked salmon promotion in Germany. where we saw quadrupled sales reaching $2.3 million in 3 months, and this is, again, another huge traditional sockeye market for us. And then it also, you know, the prize winners on the promotion had the opportunity to come on a trade press mission to Ketchikan, Juneau, and Kodiak in August. So we showed them firsthand to bring the information back and kind of keep the story going. Next, United Kingdom canned salmon. As we know, these large runs in 2013 was a record run of salmon in terms of numbers when you take all five species combined. In 2015 was a record number in terms of poundage when you take all species combined. That's put a huge strain on the canned salmon market, which, you know, when the processors are plugged, they can't freeze enough. They put it in cans. More shelf life. Well, we went to work with Tesco, among others, and UK is our largest traditional canned salmon market, and we saw an increases during this particular promotion of over 1,000% in sales value, over 850% over the time of the promotion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
I think it's fascinating about canned salmon because that's the way that used to be the primary way the product was preserved in the past, but. I was just reading a study of recommendations for people who haven't any much money, and it made recommendations on what the best value was. One thing I recall it was like dried beans. The other one was canned salmon. The value in protein in a can of salmon. So, are we seeing less and less canned salmon being produced? I know United Kingdom is a major market, but there must be other major markets as well.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, there was a great push, and it was part of the great work done here with the combination of the legislature and the industry to go away from canned salmon. Things like the Salmon Product Development Tax Credit, which was just instrumental in developing new things like the now ubiquitous salmon burger that we all see at Costco. Any of those number of products that came out to try to kind of get away from canned salmon. But you know, because the market is generally shrinking, generally aging out. It's kind of a traditional thing, and some millennials don't even have a can opener, I'm finding out. So just the product form becomes difficult to deal with. But when you're faced with some huge runs, well, you know, the way to preserve for the fish, the limiting factor is first they try to freeze, get as much out fresh, and then they freeze as much as they can, and then they can everything that's left. So that created a surplus, which, you know, at the time looked like potentially, you know, multiple years surplus just from 2013. But the combined effort of things like this canned salmon promotion at Tesco and accessing to the food aid program where the United States government bought more than $30 million worth of canned pinks a couple years ago and kind of did the same thing for sockeyes and pinks again this year to put into food banks around the country has been instrumental in kind of leveling the playing field for the value.
Thank you.
Moving on, e-commerce is a growing place for us and some place where we look for bang for the buck. I mean, the China in particular, the UK, and we're starting to see this in the United States more and more with things like Fresh Direct from Amazon, where in New York City you can have your groceries delivered to your house in less than an hour. You just put the order in online. Well, they've been doing this in China in particular for a long time, and so the buy-in for us is really nice and low with a $5,000 promotion getting, you know, depending on the promotion, we're talking about $1 to $2.4 million worth of sales as a result. Gets our messaging out there, and then when Alibaba, which is like Amazon, eBay, Facebook, and Twitter all rolled into one, went public at their IPO, the CEO touted Alaska Seafood as one of the great examples of how there was opportunity for, you know, e-commerce in China for American companies.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, throughout your presentation, I keep thinking, and we all do, and we do this all the time, as we compare the tourism industry and the marketing program to the seafood industry. And, you know, you can't just call up an e-commerce site and ask them to deliver Mount McKinley to your doorstep. So I think it, again, highlights, you know, some of the unique differences between what we're delivering, but at the same time, I think we're all eager to see, you know, where we can do co-promotions, and you mentioned one earlier, which I thought was very interesting, just to get more mileage for our marketing dollars that we do invest, so appreciate this presentation.
And moving on, if we were going to do any one event or trade show in the year, it would be the Seafood Expo Global in Brussels. It's the largest seafood trade show in the world. We host a pavilion, the Alaska Pavilion, that supports 20 companies from Alaska to sell products. We looked at about $50 million in sales in at the show. I mean, they're pinning deals there, and then in follow-on, about $650 million by the people who were at that show. So from around the world, buyers and distributors come to this show, and that's a very important place for us to be.
Madam Chair,
Senator Stevens,
sorry to keep commenting, but I did have the opportunity of going to the Brussels Fish Expo. And what really impressed me is that ASME, a state agency, had a big booth, lots of people selling a lot of product, and right next to it was Norway, a nation. You know, so here we are as a state competing with a nation. That's pretty impressive, I think.
Thank you for your interesting comments throughout this meeting, Senator Stevens. Thank you.
You told me to shut up anytime.
No.
And moving on to the next slide, Eat Alaska. You may have seen it at your local farmers market or New Sagaya or Safeways around the state. We worked with 20 chefs in Alaska to produce recipes that featured both seafood and Alaska-grown vegetables, and called it out both online and in cards. We had the bear hanging out in stores. We had tote bags, but then these are the kinds of things where we help promote, the tourism-based industries with the restaurants that participated and provided them with materials, as well as the farmers that supply the vegetables throughout the farmers markets. And, you know, this program was used at a tourism event when we talked with press. They all got a handful of it, and so to kind of lead them on to some ideas of people to talk to. So that's an area of coordination that I'm pretty proud of. And next slide, thank you. Of course, any questions either now or follow up, we're more than happy to take on.
Any questions? Thank you. Appreciate you coming today. And if there are any questions, members, just let us know, and we'll either have you back or provide the information to the members. Thank you.
Thank you.
So due to time, we've moved the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing to another meeting. I know that's an ongoing issue with the professional licensing boards and their funding. So we will have that on Thursday. And now we have the pleasure of having Division Director Lori Winghire from the Division of Insurance to give us an update on what's new, what's happening in her division.
Thank you. If I can find our presentation here.
Okay. Do you need an at ease?
I might.
Okay. We'll take a brief at ease.
Thank
you. I call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee back to order. Chair Costello will be joining us here very shortly, so in the interim I'll take over. So we're hearing now from the State Division of Insurance. So thanks very much for being here, Director Wingheiler. So during the past few years, Alaskans have seen a steep climb in the cost of their health insurance. And so I'm looking forward to you illuminating some of the reasons for that. So thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, members of the committee. Again, my name is Lori Winghire, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. And before you, you have a presentation that we have prepared. Some of it may be a little bit of a refresher of what we have discussed in previous meetings and such when we have talked about health care insurance. And I want to clarify that when we came here, we did not come to talk about property and casualty and other insurances that the division does regulate. I don't know why those seem to be more on the back burner and don't seem to be receiving the press, but certainly if you have any questions about those, I'd be happy to answer them, just for the record. The Division of Insurance is tasked with regulating the insurance industry and to protect the insurance, the consumers. They're buying a product, they're paying a premium, and most importantly, they're expecting that for that premium, there will be a payment back to them when a claim is presented. And for that reason, the insurance companies file rates with the division, which we then are tasked to look at to make sure that the rates are neither excessive, that they're not inadequate, and that they're not unfairly discriminatory. In not being adequate, one of the main things we're looking at is that the rates must support that the company will remain solvent. The company needs to be there when the claim is presented. And any insurer, be it a health care insurer, to title insurance, to property insurance, casualty, workers' compensation, when they file the rate, looking at the claims that have been paid historically, the demographics going forward, the data that is presented, the rate has to make sense for the exposure. The same is true for excessive. The rate cannot be overly charging the consumer. They cannot put into the rate filing a premium that is going to be excessive for profit. They cannot put into the rate a means for medical care that we feel and when reviewing is not there based on the historical data. In the ACA, we are finally to a point where we have 3 years of data. We have 14, 15, and now we will be looking at, in 2017, we will be looking at the 2016 year filing. So for the first time, because this is the market that is getting the most attention in the media, is the ACA individual market, we're starting to have our own data to know kind of what that market, to what to expect, and where that market, or how that market is going to react in the state of Alaska. The last thing we look at is to make sure the rates are not unfairly discriminatory. That doesn't mean you can't discriminate. You can rate on age, you can rate on location, but you cannot be unfair in how you are rating. And we do check those factors. Unfortunately, we have calls, and I know they come into your office because sometimes you forward them to us. They go to the governor's office, and they come into our office. The statute does not allow us to disapprove a rate because of the impact it has on one's pocketbook. So if a rate does double 40%, and that's close to what the rates were this year in the individual market, the 2016 rates, the impact it has on someone's budget is not a criteria that can be used. And again, that gets back to the solvency of the insurance companies. It's an unfortunate matter, but we're looking at to make sure that that insurance company is kept solid. I'm going to skip the slide.
Can I ask, Madam Chair?
Senator Stevens.
Just so I understand, I hear what you're saying about it can't be unfairly discriminatory due to age or to location. Is there anything else that would be discriminatory, like, for example, male, female? I don't know. I mean, what else is there?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, depending on what we are rating, I mean, auto insurance, perhaps, health insurance, not so much. So, I mean, these three criteria apply to all insurances, not just health care insurance. So depending on which type of insurance we are, there are different rating guidelines as to how one can rate the particular insurance product.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, when companies submit to you or try to convince you that they'll become insolvent if you don't approve their, what we've seen are dramatic increases to consumers, in charges, do they tell you about their profitability and their return to shareholders, and how deep does your review go in terms of determining solvency or all the other things that go into a business enterprise?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, not just through the rate review process, but also through our financial examinations, we are looking at their profitability and what they are returning to shareholders. And in the ACA, there are what is known as medical loss ratios, so that we can look to see of how much of the premium they are actually spending on medical care, as opposed to other costs that the insurance company may have.
And Madam Chair, if I could continue, so it's solely up to you, Director, to decide what's reasonable and what's allowable. There's a, you know, you've made reference to it, there's a tremendous amount of outrage and dissatisfaction and suspicion about the lack of standing up on the part of the state for consumers across the state. And I'm just wondering if we could get into more detail about how you're making these decisions, because you're attempting to justify here to the committee your actions, but I don't think we've dug deep enough into this, Madam Chair, and if this is the time to do it, I'd like to continue.
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, we look at in justifying the rates that we approve. For an example, if I look at one of the insurers on the exchange, in a period of 18 months, they had close to $60-some million in losses. If I divide that by the number of enrollees they had, each enrollee would have to pay close to $7,000 per person. Now, by the guidelines of the ACA, as we were just discussing with Senator Stevens, by age and location, that may vary as to who pays that money. But just to cover the cost of paying those claims, that is expensive, and we understand that. That doesn't allow any money for adjudicating those claims, for processing the claims. That is just paying the cost of the claim itself. There's no profit. There's no processing. It's simply the claims cost divided by the number of enrollees, plain and simple. Does that answer your question, sir? Because I can certainly...
Partially. I'm just still working through the details. Madam Chair, to the Director, do you and the Walker administration have any ideas for statutory or regulatory changes that could make the process more transparent, accountable, consumer-friendly, striking maybe a better balance between the industry and the consumer here in the state of Alaska? I understand we only have a couple of carriers and there are increasing cost pressures. It takes me back to your predecessor, Linda Hall, who at the time when the ACA was just getting going, or preceding that, there was federal money available to study in Alaska why doctors and healthcare providers in the state of Alaska charge dramatically more than anybody else in the United States. And there, it was the beginning of the rise in medical tourism, people flying to Thailand or Mexico or wherever, or the state of Alaska sending people away from us to them to get their medical costs covered as a cost-saving measure. It was sort of embarrassing and ridiculous, and people were wondering why the state of Alaska wasn't, and people wondered why Ms. Hall, who was well-respected in her time in your position of refusing, and it was under a different governor who was highly suspicious of the federal government in many respects, but Ms. Hall, Director Hall, turned down the federal money to investigate why doctors and hospitals in Alaska charge our system more than anybody else for the same procedures. And there was a migration to Seattle and elsewhere for those services. Do you know, through the chair, if any of those federal dollars are still available for that study, and why in the world, maybe you have a different rationale than Ms. Hall did at the time, would you be willing, if that money were available, to take the money and figure out why we are overcharged, the state of Alaska, other entities, and consumers generally for the same procedures by doctors and hospitals here compared to our neighbors to the south?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, I think you walk a line. I certainly am concerned about the cost of health care, because I think it is the principal driver of health care insurance.
Yes.
There's no doubt. We have struggled with how do we get the providers to the table. We have spent a great deal of time looking at some of our other states, Rhode Island and Vermont, who have worked very hard at bringing the providers to the table, and even within the rate filings of why the projected costs are what they are, and should the providers have a seat at the table. We've also looked at the other side of almost trade practices and restraint of trade and the impact it would have on what some would say is a fragile or small medical community. And would we stifle the growth of the medical community in Alaska? And where is that line, and who draws it? And I don't know that I have the answer for you, sir, but I can tell you that we have looked very hard at what Rhode Island has done and some other states who are bringing the providers to the table and trying to justify the cost of the medical services within the rates as they are passed on to the consumer. The problem we have in Alaska is the small medical community and the options to drive somewhere else. Having a larger medical community and the options to drive somewhere else or access health care closer than having to buy a plane ticket to Seattle or Portland or wherever one might choose to get medical services performed. As far as federal dollars, to the best of my knowledge, there is not any longer federal dollars involved for anything like that. When King versus Burwell was being heard and we were concerned about what the outcome of King versus Burwell was, we were looking for federal dollars then, and there were not any.
Senator Ellis, do you have any further questions?
I guess we missed that opportunity for the research and study to figure out why we're so out of whack compared to other jurisdictions on the cost of health care. We're a captive audience, apparently.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're actually an island economy, in a sense. And you know, Director, you're sitting on the hot seat today, and it's a hot topic, and I know you're not the person who has that magic bullet, but we get to ask you questions about how you might contribute to the solution. So a couple days ago, perhaps it was yesterday, January 15th, whatever today is, 4 days ago, I guess, there was an article in APRN that talked about the 80th percentile rule. I found this very interesting. Full disclosure, I am a healthcare provider, and I am appalled at what particularly specialty care costs in our state. I note that two large orthopedic practices were cited in this article. I believe you were asked about this. And I understand just a couple days ago those two practices merged, so that now they've become even more of a single entity. I'm not going to use that other word that starts with an M, but we have a lot of practices like that that are massively large. There is no competition. But how does this 80th percentile rule play into the issue we're faced with in terms of healthcare costs?
Through the chair, Senator, 15 years ago or so, there were a lot of complaints into the division that when someone received a treatment, they got a bill. And they didn't understand why they had insurance and why were they getting a bill after the service or the treatment was performed and they still owed so much. And there was not a rule, per se, that said an insurance company shall pay X amount. So this 80th percentile was established as basically a threshold for what the insurance companies would pay at for all physicians. Well, if you're in network, there's a negotiated rate, and most of us are pretty happy with our negotiated rate of our providers because you know you're getting a preferred rate, and generally there's not a bill due that you end up having to pay because you used an in-network provider in your insurance plan. However, if you go out of network, you're subject to what the physician charges, and your insurance company is only going to pay that 80th percentile. Well, certain physicians have learned that when you're, for lack of a better word, when there's one or two of you, you can set the 80th percentile because you're the game in town. So you can set your fee so that the 80th percentile, you'll get what you want. And the rates have gone up, or the fees have gone up, so that the rates are seeing, we're now seeing it in the rate. And so the question is, has the 80th percentile outlived its usefulness? We are not opposed to reopening the regulation. We're the only state in the nation that has such a regulation. But it was done as a protective measure for consumers, and we don't want to undo it if it's going to do harm to the consumers. If it's going to bring down rates, then we are absolutely for looking into it and seeing what it would do to rates if it was, we did not have the 80th percentile. But if it's going to harm consumers, there's already enough concern over the rates right now without them having their bills being paid at something less than the 80th percentile. So we're looking at it to say, okay, what would the claims be paid at out of network if it wasn't the 80th percentile? So we are doing some research, and it's not a dead topic. It's just something that we need to be certain that the claims out of network, again, it's not the in network for providers, but the out of network, what will the claims be paid at? And what will the consumers be paying if the 80th percentile does not exist? But we are certainly receiving calls on it right now.
Senator Giesel.
So Director, who is doing the research for you? I mean, how in-depth, what kind of consultant are you using? Are you doing it in-house?
Through the chair, Senator, we are doing it in-house. And we are also using, or I should say working with the insurers. Mm-hmm. We're working with the broker community as they are the Alaska Association of Health and Underwriters, I want to say AHU. I should know their full name, but I just know them as AHU. But we are working, they're working with us as, and providing data. We're researching it, not so that we don't want to be biased one way or the other, but we're looking at the insurers. We're looking at the data from the filings. We're doing as best of a review of what we have to determine where we would be if the 80th percentile were no longer in play.
Oh, Senator Giesel, please.
When do you expect you'll have some kind of conclusion? Do you have any anticipated deadline for that?
To the chair, again, Senator Giesel, we don't. I don't want to rush it. It would not have an impact immediately on the rates. Mm-hmm. I would like to see it done before we finalize the 2017 rates, which would be either late August, early September of 2016. But I can't commit that we would have it done June or July. But if we were going to do something, it would be later this year.
One last question, Madam Chair.
Madam
Chair, would it be possible for you to stay in touch with the director and perhaps let the committee know when that that study is concluded and perhaps dissipate it to us, if that's possible, if it were public?
Absolutely, and certainly we will have Ms. Winghire back, and if there are any further deeper dives that any committee members would like to take on any of this, just let me know, and we will certainly accommodate you.
Thank you. Okay. I am on page 3, and it's just some acronyms and terms that we use so that if I start talking quickly that I'm not totally losing you. And so then jumping ahead to page or slide 4, this is kind of the progression of the ACA plan. You may have seen this slide before. I've added a little bit to it. The reason I wanted to talk to you about it is because we're coming upon some key dates of when things are going to change. Of course, the ACA came about in March 23rd, 2010, when President Obama signed it. We started our first enrollment in January 2014, but between that time period, in late 2013, President Obama allowed certain insurers or certain employers to keep their insurance plan. There was a problem with the exchange. People were uncertain about the Affordable Care Act, And there became this saying, if you like your insurance, you can keep it. And so we came up with what we called the grandfathered and the non-grandfathered plans. The grandfathered plans are such that if you had insurance before 2010, you can basically keep that plan for as long as there are no, I will say, major changes to keep it simple. That plan can exist into forever. The non-grandfathered plans, they were set to expire for, I want to believe the first time was the end of 2014. They are now set to expire 2016, October 2016. But in saying that, if they renew in October of 2016, they could run technically until June 30, 2017. As we go through this, you will see that those plans will go into the individual market, making our market a little bit larger. So I just wanted to point that out, that you will see that number change. On the other hand, as we go through this, you will see that in the small group, there are some non-grandfathered plans that we're hearing rumors about that they are going to let those plans continued in a non-grandfathered status for CMSs and SSIO for some time. We don't know if those are going to, if that's legitimate or not, but there are rumors in the health insurance industry that those plans may continue. But in theory, eventually, all plans should end up as ACA compliant plans. But right now, we are operating basically, and for rates, forms, and filings, we are approving grandfathered, non-grandfathered, and ACA compliant plans.
Ms. Winghire, I just want to mention we have about five more minutes for the committee, so if there's anything you wanted to gloss over rather than go into detail about.
Slide six shows you just some progressions of the numbers 2014-15, as does slide seven. The first numbers are all on slide six are all grandfathered, non-grandfathered, and ACA compliant plans. That number was just meant to show you that even if I add them all up together, we're a pretty small market. The next one is to show you just breaking it out by insurance company. As there was a lot of press, you know that we've lost Aetna and Insurant in the market. Those plans have rolled up into, in 2015, or in 2016, into the Premera and Moda markets, but as they have left the state in the individual market in 2016. The small group numbers you can see, if I'm going too fast, please yell at me. But looking at slide 10, you wanted to know, one of the questions that Weston had asked was for me to talk about 10 potential cost drivers. And where am I? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going the wrong way. Okay. Healthcare cost and utilization. Prescription drugs, the increase of cost for services and the number of times or where people are being treated, healthcare costs and utilization will have an impact on insurance when we look at rates in 2017. The changes to the essential health benefits will have a change, will have an impact on rates. We do not expect any changes to the 2000 EHBs in Alaska. The CMS actuarial value calculator will have an impact on Alaska. That is, in all fairness, that is where we look at the cost-sharing structure. And when all is said and done, that will probably have a negative impact on our rates in 2017. However, we do have credible data, as we will now have Alaska 3 years of data that we hope will stabilize our rates somewhat. I just talked to you a little bit about the migration of the grandfathered and the non-grandfathered plans into the ACA individual and small group market. We think that will help improve the health of the pool, make it a little bit larger, and hopefully stabilize it some. The insurers merging and exiting will have an impact on us. We've lost Aetna. We've lost Assurant. If you've read the trades, you probably know that Aetna and Humana are considering a merger. Cigna and Anthem are considering a merger. United Healthcare is rumored to be pulling out of the individual market. Those would all have impacts on Alaska. There's ongoing uncertainty with court cases and the elections that will impact the rate filings and the ACA as a whole. I'll talk about the 3 hours, the reinsurance, the risk corridor, and the adjustment here in a minute. There are some taxes, some excise taxes that are coming up, the big one being the health insurance provider, which I think is 23%. It doesn't impact everything within the ACA, but 23% is a pretty good, healthy chunk excise tax. Alaska on slide 10, of course, our health cost of health care, limited providers, challenges with provider networks. After all is said and done, I expect the pool when will settle out somewhere between $20,000 and $22,000 this year, and the fact that national cost drivers will impact us. CMS has issued over 100 revisions for the 2017 plan year. Some of it has to do with out-of-pocket expenses, the certification process, the uniform modifications, network adequacies, riders contained within the plan and such, but those will all have impacts on our plan, maybe not cost, but they will have impacts. Medical trends, again, the transition of the non-grandfathered plans and the mergers and acquisitions. The last thing I want to talk to you about, or not the last, but when we look at the three R's, and this is something that has had an impact. The three R's were part of the ACA when it was passed in 2010, and they were meant to stabilize the market. Two of them are sunsetting in 2016. You can almost count on that will have an impact on rates going into 2017. And I hope I've given a decent description of what they've done. The big one I want to talk about is the risk corridor, and it's the last bullet there. And very briefly, when we talked about stabilizing insolvency of insurance companies, the risk corridor in 2000, when they went to make the 2014 payments in 2015, as you can see, how it was expected to work was if an insurance company had profits, excessive profits, the federal government was to claw back the money and pay it to those that didn't. Well, insurance companies didn't have profits, and they went to the Hill for money. And the Congress said, we are not going to fund it. So insurance companies that were planning on getting X amount of money got 12.6% of what they were anticipating. And it led to certain insurance companies, not in Alaska, but insurance companies and co-ops basically becoming insolvent. What they will be able to pay in 15 and 16, as they should have been able to, remains to be seen. But it is something we are watching, and we expect it is something that will have an impact on the rates. Things we could look at is a Section 1332, much like Colorado, Minnesota, Hawaii, and Massachusetts are. We have looked at it, but as Senator Ellis had brought up, are we looking at anything that we could do in the future? Yes, but we were looking for the market to stabilize a little so we could know what we are dealing with as far as costs and what the market looked like instead of jumping in and being surprised at how the market is responding in Alaska. Give you some information on 14 of what a Section 1332 waiver is. Other solutions, there is a bill that is being drafted by Premier and Moda for a possible reinsurance program that would be administered by CHIA, possibly a regional exchange with other Pacific Northwest states, possibly combining the individual and small group markets to spread the risk amongst both would bring the rates down. Things we're considering. All may not make everyone happy, but they're things that we're considering to possibly bring the rates down and impact the individual market. I know we're out of time. I'm happy to come back anytime when you have more time to talk about health care. I'm here for the 90 plus days, whatever, so I am around.
Thank you, Ms. Wing-Hire. And Senator Stevens.
You know, I understand that your biggest headache is probably health insurance and the ACA and the fact that there are fewer insurers. But I'd also like to know more about property and casualty insurance. Are you seeing a similar situation there where there are fewer carriers in the state of Alaska? And maybe that's another discussion we should have at some time. But that's also an important part of your job, I would assume.
Through the chair, it's equally important in the state of Alaska as the property and casualty market. And it's stable. They'd like to see a few things changed in statute, but they are a stable market. The rates remain stable. pretty much neutral right now. We're happy to see some movement from the National Flood Insurance Program to a private flood market. So in all things being equal, we're pleased right now with the status of the property and casualty market, but I'm happy to come back and talk about it.
So no loss of companies in the market?
No, not anything to speak of.
Thank you, and certainly we will have you back, and if members have any further questions, let my staff know or myself, and we will certainly follow up with Senator Giesel's earlier comment. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I think one of the things that's it has impressed me is the scope of the work of the department. We've gone from tourism to seafood to insurance. There's a lot more in the department, too, but I really appreciate your time with us, and we'll let you know if members send me any questions. We'll pass them on to you, and we'll have you back. So, with that,
thank you for having us.
The committee's adjourned.